back to another episode of the Lumieres podcast. I'm Jody White, your host for this little adventure we're having. We're on episode number five now, and we've only been going a couple of months, and we're already just 100-150 or so listens short of 1,000 downloads, which is awesome. I never realized when I started this, I didn't really have any expectations, really. I just felt a drive to do it, and I wanted to meet some of these people that I've been wanting to talk with, you know, for a long time. And the ethos really was just to spread the message, spread their word, allow these great people to talk a little bit about what they do and why they do it. So to have almost 1,000 people tuning in already, we're only small, you know. It's just me doing this, and it means a lot to have people listening. And thank you to all the people who've sent me messages of support and saying they enjoyed it, and you know, that kind of thing. It's really great to hear, and it really keeps me going. And if you like the podcast and you want to help, you can share it with all your friends. Tell people who you think might enjoy it. You can leave me a quick little review on iTunes. That'd be amazing. And subscribe too if you want to receive new episodes as they're released, which is roughly every couple of weeks, depending on what else I'm up to. So today we have a fantastic chat with Dr. David Luke, who is a psychologist, psychedelic researcher, did his PhD on the psychology of luck, and now teaches a course called, Exceptional Human Experience at Greenwich University, amongst many other things. He's an author, he's an academic, he's a writer, he edits books, he's on several panels, and he also co-founded the Breaking Convention Conference, which is happening again this year. Breaking Convention is an international conference on psychedelic study, psychedelic consciousness. There's hundreds of speakers. They have parties, art installations, video. It's just, it's going to be great. I've been meaning to go for a number of years, and I've finally got my ticket this year. It's held at Greenwich University, and the dates are, I think, Friday the 30th of June until Sunday the 2nd of June. So if you go to breakingconvention.co.uk, you can find out more about that and get your tickets. David obviously I expect he's speaking. I don't know if he is speaking. But him, and along with a crew of a few other people, he founded that conference. And we touch a little bit on that in the conversation today. Go check that out. And if you're around in June, start of July, I think that would be a very worthy investment of your time and money. So, David kindly made time, and like so many of these people who I send messages to saying, hey, I think you're cool, can I come and talk to you for the podcast? And they've all been so kind as to say, yeah, cool, let's sort it out. So I went over to David's place in Forest Row, and we sat outside. It was a lovely sunny day. Just, you know, some of the days we've been having the last few weeks in England here, it's just been just glorious, especially after we all wait for the winter to kind of fade away and the cold to take the edge off. And now we've got some sunshine, some warmth, which is very welcome. And we sat outside in his neighbor's garden, and we had a great little chat. There's a lot going on in there, but some fantastic topics, and I hope you enjoy it. We were interrupted by Luna, the dog, a couple of times, and later on in the podcast, I think I stopped it briefly to just check in, and then we restarted. So there might be a bit where the continuity feels a little bit off, but you probably won't notice, I think. What else to say? The last episode, Martin Shaw went down an absolute storm. We had maybe 300, 400, 500 people, I think, have listened to that already, which again, you know, blows me away considering how fresh this is and how I'm just promoting it myself on Facebook and Instagram. And it's not some gigantic media organization. It's just little old me. And It's just amazing to see that. Within a week, I think we had 200 listens. So I was very happy about that. And people seem to have been loving it. It's already got double the listens of any of the other episodes. So yeah, I'm glad you all got so much from that. And I hope you will equally enjoy this episode with Dr. David Luke today. Coming up in the next episode after this one, in a couple of weeks' time, I met with a lovely guy by the name of Andreas Cornival, and he's a musician, he's a storyteller, he runs a charity where they plant woodland and wildflower meadows. He also started the Life Cairn movement for which is just, oh, it's wonderful. It's basically creating spaces where people can grieve for extinct species. So I mean, it's a similar concept as the tombstone in the graveyard of a family member or a friend. You know, it focuses your energy on a place to grieve. And I think grief is something that's we find hard to express in our culture quite often. It's kind of, people feel uncomfortable around grieving people. They don't really know how to grieve themselves or what they're really grieving for. And there's this idea of ecological grief at the moment, and this is what the Life Cairn is attached to. So anyone can do it. You speak to Andreas first, but the basic idea is it's a cairn of stones, and each stone represents a species that's gone extinct, and allows you to visit there personally in your own time and express your grief for that in whatever way you feel to, really. I think that's such a great thing. So yeah, we'll talk a bit about that and a lot of other things in the next episode with Andreas Cornival. So I hope you tune in for that. I hope you enjoyed today with Dr. David Luke. If you did, tell your friends, share it about. Let's get the ball rolling a little bit. And yeah, have a great couple of weeks. Springtime, time to awaken, everybody. Time to get your creativity on. Time to enjoy the sunshine. Hello. I'm with Dr. David Luke. We're sitting outside in the sunshine in Forest Row in February, which is weird, but nice. And for people who don't know you and what you do, could you give like some sort of little summary about your kind of the area that you work in and, you know, how you spend your time these days?
Yeah, so I'm an academic primarily, based at the University of Greenwich. And I teach a course there on the psychology of exceptional human experience, which includes all weird and wonderful things from, you know, the paranormal to transpersonal and anomalistic, to give it some labels, which basically means altered states of consciousness and kind of strange experiences that occur, you know, be it with psychedelics or meditation or hypnosis or dreams. But essentially, you could boil it down to kind of weird people having weird experiences in weird places, taking weird things or doing weird things.
Yes, it's kind of experimentation and exploration of the self.
Yeah.
So how did you come to kind of, where did you start off getting into all this stuff? I imagine it starts with your own experiences somewhere along the way.
Yeah, but I can't pinpoint any one experience, but I always had an interest in the kind of the other, if you like. So that would be, you know, kind of bunking off school, and instead of reading the things you're meant to read at school, I'd go into the secondhand bookshops and read the kind of the weird occult mystical section, you know, books, and give myself an education that way.
So is that like kind of like teenage years, or are you talking
a bit
older?
Kind of teenage years, your young teenage years, and then kind of experimenting with my own kind of neurochemistry a bit. And you know, I've always had an interest in altered states, and I seem to have a knack for them, you know, since kind of spinning around in circles so you fall over from as soon as you can walk to, you know, so on and so forth.
It's almost like kids are kind of, they're kind of pre-wired to try that stuff and really enjoy it and just push things like that. You know, they love that kind of like, oh, I feel so dizzy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all do.
Yeah,
you know,
it's something inherent.
Yeah, we like to kind of get into altered states. Not everybody feels comfortable with it, but, you know, there is a kind of general yearning, isn't there, in people to kind of have a weirder experience, you know?
Yeah, explore kind of what it is to be here and what that means to be experiencing being alive and all those kind of things, even if they're not like consciously aware that's what they're doing, it's kind of what they're doing.
Yeah.
So where does that go into, where does it go from the personal to kind of taking it into more of a kind of almost scientific...
Almost scientific. Well, I do try almost. And be scientific.
You are. Would you say you're a scientist?
Yeah, I'm a scientist. Yeah.
So, because that's a really interesting thing, I think, when you're talking about altered states, because so many people, they have these kind of experiences, and then I don't know. Sometimes critical thinking doesn't come into it, and it's interesting to be approaching that kind of stuff with your own experiences from that kind of like, well, so actually, what is going on here, like. Which parts of my brain are firing, and you know, is that the side that you kind of mean by?
Yeah,
the
partly. I mean, well, I use a scientific method, not only, but you know, also in my kind of research. So, be that, you know, using quantitative statistics, experimentation, or surveys, or you know, through to just ethnography, just going out in the field and. Kind of exploring, kind of more from an anthropological perspective and first person perspective, and. Just experiencing as well. So it's kind of like being on both sides of the line of subjective and objective, because I don't think there's really such a thing as objectivity. You know, all science is biased. People start out, you know, when they generate their hypotheses and the questions they ask are biased in the very first place. You know, you can try and be objective in what you find, but there's always a personal element to all research and all science.
Sure.
And... Yeah, I think it's also important because when you're talking about altered states, you wouldn't trust a sexologist who was a virgin or a musicologist who was deaf. You know, Beethoven notwithstanding. Yeah.
But how do you... I mean, there's a point where your personal experiences... What am I trying to say here?
I know what you're trying to say. What are you accusing me of?
I think I've lost the thread of what I was going down with that.
No, I mean, the subjective-objective divide is quite a tricky thing to negotiate, isn't it? I mean, it's like, do you lose a kind of rational perspective once you're in an altered state? Well, maybe to some extent, but that's partly why you want to explore these old states, you know?
Yeah.
They certainly give you a different view of the world. There was a guy called Charles Tart, for instance, who came up with this idea of state-specific sciences in the 70s. So all science and all academia is kind of viewed from the sober, coffee-fueled, you know, waking state of consciousness. Yeah, but, I mean, you can look at science from the inside, from other states of consciousness as well, and you gain different insights into it. I mean, you then want to go away and kind of verify it in a kind of sober state, but... So some of these are things you can only really get out from a first-person perspective, I think.
Interesting. That's fascinating. It seems like a lot of scientists, you know, that kind of exploration, especially of things that are considered fringe, it gets kind of frowned upon still. And kind of, have you experienced any kind of resistance or kind of, you know, professionally, as you started to kind of go down this area of altered states research and...
Not really. I think most other academics just tend to ignore my work. So, I mean, if I was to, you know, upset somebody enough that kind of criticised me, then that'd be great. But, you know, I think because it's out of most people's area of expertise, so they don't really kind of... I haven't received much criticism at all, but then my work is so kind of liminal that most people don't even look into it particularly. Or if they do, they don't engage with it kind of academically, you know, very much. So I haven't really been in much of a firing line. I have had some criticism for an experiment I did, which was a self-experiment on precognition and San Pedro cactus, which contains mescaline. Mm. And somebody rightly said, well, you know, but you were in an altered state when you did the experiment. And I said, well, that's true, but I know I was able to function and perform the experiment. But it's only one piece of evidence, right? It's just it's just a proof of principle. Mm. It worked, by the way. you know, and it's there for somebody else to kind of build upon as science progresses and verify it. But you know,
so what was the kind of experiment that you're talking about there?
So, I mean, originally planned to kind of do the experiment with 20 other people, and they'd do a trial each under the influence of San Pedro cactus, and it was a experimental paradigm for parapsychology where you get people to pick a target. They don't know what the target is. It's like four video clips, and they have to try and visualize which one of those is going to be the target, which they then find out later. So it's a precognition task. So they're accessing some information from the future, which they can't infer. So it's know, it's kind of watertight, a bit abstract, but you can't really cheat it. You know, you're trying to get information about something which hasn't happened yet, because you pick the target after they make their selection. I couldn't get 20 people to do it, so I did it myself.
Surprising.
And I did 20 trials of it. Well, I probably could have done, but...
when was this?
It was in Ecuador a few years ago. But,
whereabouts in Ecuador? I love Ecuador.
All over, really, but I think this was... it's somewhere up in the Andes. It was near Cuenca.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It wasn't down in Vilcabamba.
No, I went to Vilcabamba, though. Great place.
Yeah, I love Ecuador, man. I had such an amazing formative time there, like late 2009, 2010, I was there. I spent a good few months in Ecuador, Peru. Had my first kind of... plant kind of medicine experiences, and ayahuasca and San Pedro, both, you know, still those first experiences you always remember, I guess, but as first experiences went, they couldn't have got much more incredible.
It'll do that for you, won't it? I mean, Ecuador's amazing like that. It's just, it's a tiny little place. It's like the size of Wales, but it's, you've got the Amazon, you've got the Andes, you've got incredible beaches.
That's what blew my mind, like the diversity of landscapes all contained within that. Yeah. You can be on a bus from like the high Andes, go past a volcano and end up in a banana plantation at the end of the day. Like,
that's amazing.
And of course, the cactus is native to Ecuador.
Actually, yeah, yeah.
Or some variants of that cactus. But going back to the experiment, you were talking about how did that, what sort of results did you get when you were doing, how did you do, like, did you do it all in one go or did you do it in
Over the space of one day, you know, kind of took me about 8 hours. So the idea is you have, first of all, you take the mescaline. Or the cactus with the mescaline in it, and then you wait until you stop feeling sick. Well, I did. It was a couple of hours. And then,
A couple of hours.
I had, but it lasts 12 hours, so you got the next 10 hours then. And I had a researcher kind of prepare me pools of video clips. And so there was like four video clips in each pool, and they were made to be as different from each other as possible. They were 1 minute long, and they were just taken from random films. So I had overall I had 80 of these clips. It was 20 trials, four at a time. And so first of all, you try and visualize what the target is. You don't know what the target's going to be. It's just a video clip. You'd write something down. So like my first one was eyes. Ancient Greek scene, city at night on a lake. And then I'd watch the four clips, and the first clip of those four happened to be a scene from, I don't know, Jason the Argonaut, something like that.
Whoa.
No, it's something with a guy fighting a minotaur with kind of in a Greek uniform, kind of armour, and a, you know, kind of plumed helmet.
So it couldn't have been more accurate.
Well, that was pretty good. There was no city at night on a lake, but there was, you know, the Greek, ancient Greek.
So
I was like, oh, that was pretty, that wasn't even, I wasn't even counting that one. That was just to see if I could actually do it, you know, function, you know, because it was quite high. And so then I'd watch four clips, and then I would select which one was most like my visualization. Mm-hmm. So clearly I would have selected that one, but I wasn't even looking at that, the first trial. And then from there on in, you'd make your selections, from the four clips, you'd rank order them, and then you'd get the computer to just randomly select one of the four clips as a target. So it's after the fact. There's way you can know what the computer's going to select. It uses a random number generator. And so it's completely independent. And sure, you should by chance alone get 25%, right? Sure. One in four. Statistically, it was much better than that. But the real juice was in the actual qualitative stuff, you know. So, like, there was one where it's like a... Sands of time, desert sands, something like that.
Yeah.
And that was all I wrote down. Just like I'd write down just the first bit of kind of concrete mental imagery, you know.
So was it more based on your imagery than like feeling or emotions or any other kind of input?
No, I was working on kind of mental imagery because it was, I'd taken the dose which was just suitable so that when you close your eyes, you get a lot more mental imagery.
Okay.
It gives you something tangible because you're working with video as well. So
Yeah.
But I'll go for anything. But, you know, more. The difficulty was, like, the mental imagery I was having was so fluid and dynamic, you couldn't really pin it down.
Pick out one little bit,
and then you'd kind of get something and go, right, I'll write that down. Uh-huh. You'd watch the clips. And so for that one, there was an image of a kind of sidewinder snake in one of the video clips going across a desert. So, right, that's the target. Mm. Gave it, like, high confidence rating, and then ran the random number generator, and sure enough, that was the target. So, say...
Wow.
There was a few like that. It was great. Yeah.
So I imagine that was pretty inspiring to you, getting those kind of results and being like, this, you know, this is confirming what I'm...
Oh, yeah.
What I'm trying to prove here.
Yeah, it was quite self-confirmatory.
Did that inspire kind of later, later experiments in the same kind of...
I haven't followed through on that, really. I did just do recently a LSD precognition study, but that hasn't been published yet, and it's embargoed, so I can't say anything about that.
Oh, right, okay.
But okay. I have done it.
Yeah, what do you think about the whole kind of renaissance of these kind of substances and experimentation and research in these areas? It seems to be starting to filter through the governmental systems now, having been shut down for such a long time, sadly. I mean, it feels like there's a lot more acceptance, or the society's maybe a little more ready for that kind of thing to come back as a legitimate therapeutic tool. And
someone
who's kind of very much practically involved in the current state of things, like, where do you see that kind of, how do you see it at the moment, and where do you see it going?
Well, first of all, I think it's great that it's happening again. I mean, like, when Prohibition happened, you know, 50 years ago or so, it didn't stop people taking psychedelics. In fact, you know, as with all drugs,
never really works.
No, the numbers just increased, you know. Prohibition didn't really work by its own aims, unless it just aimed to criminalise otherwise lawful people. But it did stop all the research for decades, and that's now brilliantly starting again. A lot of respectable institutions, and it's growing. And they're looking into the kind of the research that was done in the 50s and 60s, which had less scientific controls then, but they're finding pretty much the same things, that these substances have great potential therapeutic uses for, you know, psychogenic disorders like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, addictions, obsessive compulsive disorder, that's a new one, and also perhaps some direct physiological benefits as well, which now that's also being looked into. So anti-inflammatory, anti-tumor, neurogenetic, i.e. they can help you create new brain cells. So they've got lots of other properties just besides a psychotherapeutic.
Yeah, yeah. Would you include cannabis in that group of substances?
Oh, it's not even talking about cannabis. Yeah, that's a whole other kettle of fish. I mean, yeah. It doesn't seem to be much that cannabis isn't good for you.
Yeah. Panacea.
Yeah. I mean, probably because I'm not a dope smoker, I don't really do research on cannabis. But yeah, I mean, it's psychedelic, you know. It's and that's a whole research field in itself.
Where's it going to go next?
So where's it going? I mean, I think it's great, and I think we can see more and more of this happening. I think, you know, we're in a kind of weird legal kind of... Hello, this is Luna, by the way. We're recording in our neighbour's garden. Luna just wanted to join in the conversation. You think it's going to get decriminalised soon? Okay, Luna reckons, like, things are going to change for the better pretty soon.
She seems pretty confident about that as well.
Yeah. I mean, the very reason, like, drugs are illegal, certainly under the Misuse of Drugs Act, is that they have no medical use, and they're addictive, And, like, psychedelics, classic psychedelics, don't tick either of those boxes. They have medical potential, and they're not addictive, right? So they shouldn't be illegal. You know, forget what Theresa May's done with the new psychoactives bill,
but
or act. But so we're kind of moving backwards in the UK, but the rest of the world seems to be moving forward. Decriminalisation of cannabis and so on. So.
Yeah, I mean, America is something like, is it almost half of states have access to medical marijuana now or something? Really, that's a big thing.
Yeah, it's massive.
Do you think that's kind of that kind of trend that's going on over there and MAPS doing a lot more studies getting funded now? Is that, do you think that's going to spread over here eventually? This, the UK always seems like they just don't want to take risks with anything that could be seen to kind of hurt the main vote majorities and in some of these main parties. You
know? It's the swing voters they're worried about, the Daily Mail readers mostly. I mean, but it's, I mean, the situation could have been a bit more rosy, but then we got Theresa May. I didn't vote for her. I don't think anyone voted for her. Not even her own party. But I mean, as Home Secretary, she was vehemently anti-drugs. I mean, David Nutt just had a piece in The Guardian last week, saying how she's, because of her fundamentalist Christian views, she's just personally diametrically opposed to the use of all drugs apart from alcohol. And she hasn't even been willing to engage the Home Office even on the drugs issue. She refused to even engage the issue other than to bring in the Psychoactives Act. So we've kind of taken a backward step in the UK.
Yeah, letting personal kind of personal preferences override what it should be, really something that's, you know, freely able, people are freely able to study these things. It's,
well, we should at least have a decent debate about it, you know. I mean, because from so many directions, you know, like prohibition doesn't work, you know, economically, societally, etc., etc., you know, it's just a rubbish move, I think, you know.
So things like I mean, that said, you know, you're part of organising, you know, events like Breaking Convention coming up later this year, and that's that kind of thing is going to put these topics into the wider consciousness a little bit more. You know, it's an amping up again. You know, every time these kind of things happen, this concentration of energy around these subjects, you know, that's going to create ripple effects. And how did you come to start? What was the kind of origin of Breaking Convention?
Yeah, it was quite random actually. So I was planning, I've been running a kind of a salon in a art gallery in London, was just for the last 8 years, and it was you know, topics around psychedelics and anthropology and various other stuff. And I wanted to do a one-day event. At the same time, Dave King, who's a undergraduate anthropology student at Canterbury, were talking with a couple of his lecturers. They wanted to put on a one-day event as well. And then Ben Sessa, who's a psychiatrist, who had been planning to put on a one-day event at the Institute of Psychiatry, not the Institute, the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And somehow we all kind of hooked up through Dave King, actually. And we thought, well, why don't we all, instead of competing, you know, just cooperate and put on something at Canterbury. So that was meant to be like a weekend, two-day event. It kind of ended up twice the size we planned it. It was a three-day event. And then it's kept on kind of doubling in size ever since then. You know, we put it on every 2 years. And, you know, there really is a massive resurgence of interest in psychedelics. We receive more and more submissions from better and better universities and more qualified people wanting to present papers at our conference, you know. And we've reached capacity last time. And I don't know where we're going to put them all this year. So
And it seems like it's expanding out into not just talks on psychedelics and old states, but you've got like a kind of a whole program of things going on now with it started out more as a kind of
It was an academic conference, but we also had a little bit of we put on some installations from the get-go, but that whole side of things is expanded. It's like an academic conference slash festival. So we have a full art exhibition, we have installation artwork as well, we have workshops, performers, we put on after parties every night with kind of DJs and kind of light installations, and you know, there's bookstalls, there's all kinds of stuff going on, you know. So in fact, at the end of the conference, a lot of people come up to me and go, hey Dave, thanks for the great festival. And I'm like, this is a conference, guys.
A
festival,
your Michael Eavis moments. But it does seem a little bit like that, you know, like the kind of, because of the because of the taboo history of these things, like anyone who's kind of actively involved in promoting engagement with them, it starts to get seen as a bit of a countercultural figure. And, you know, it's a bit kind of, it's almost like some sort of 21st century alternative rock stardom in this world of, consciousness exploration, mm-hmm. you know.
It has a little bit of that. I don't think it's anything like in the 60s, you know, there's no Timothy Leary's or kicking around anymore. Thankfully, probably, because I think that was somewhat, counterproductive in some ways. Mm. I mean, I think a lot of what Timothy Leary said and did was really inspiring, but... And he was a kind of catalyst, and he was a kind of productive his times. But it's very different now, you know. It's like just regular scientists, consciousness researchers, and people in all other fields, psychiatrists, you know, people jobbing professionals are interested in these things for not as kind of tools of counterculture, but as kind of genuine tools of research and therapy, you know. Mm,
and so it should be.
Yeah, yeah.
I just watched this film the other day, The Sunshine Makers, which is about...
Great.
You've seen it. About the guys who originally created LSD, and they were given the message that you know, this is your job in the world is to make LSD and turn everyone on. And I was thinking, like, what do you feel like you've got any kind of mission with this work, or any what's driving your, is there kind of like a central kind of drive to what you do and this work?
I mean, for me, I went away to university. Before I went to university, I studied psychology, you know, GCSE, A-level, to try and answer these kind of questions about what happens on psychedelics, you know. And then I went and did a degree. And I was kind of woefully kind of underwhelmed and disappointed that on a whole three-year psychology degree, we got literally one little video about psychedelic experience. You know, so there was no this whole kind of massive tale of human experience wasn't even engaged with. You know, it seemed to be, I thought, it's an important part of human psychology, because if you just look at the kind of either the dysfunctional clinical stuff or the kind of everyday kind of psychology, you're missing out on a whole range of experience, which is, you know, common to a large portion of the population. And yet there was nothing on the psychology curricula that spoke to that. So that's really been my mission, is just to throw a line to those people who are coming into the academy looking to kind of explore and understand these things, and where there was no academics before, you know, I've jumped up in that place, you know.
Mm. And do you feel like that's kind of, I mean, the sort of students you're getting at the moment, is interest growing in this kind of stuff? And do you get people, do you feel like there's more and more people coming to you going, Dave, show me, you know, show me the way of psychedelic research?
Well, I mean, we get a lot of interest, yeah, definitely. I mean, my own undergraduate students come, not for me, they come for the psychology at the university, but the course I teach is very popular, you know, it always kind of oversubscribed, and I think most of the students come away having enjoyed it and learned something from it. But we also get a lot of people contacting us in their droves, wanting to do masters or PhDs and wanting to become psychotherapists, you know, working with psychedelics, and so there's a massive interest for it, and there's very little provision for those people, you know.
So it's going to be, I mean, it's going to be driven by people just doing it underground to some degree. I mean, isn't that, I think, to some, that's what sort of happened in the States with a bit of MDMA therapy, and that people just started to do it themselves, you know, like off the books, as it were.
Yeah, more so in the States for some reason, as far as I'm aware. There doesn't appear to be, there's certainly not a kind of a network of underground therapists in the UK. It's very, if they are working, they're working very clandestinely, you know. It's not, I mean, the States have always had that, but I think there are opportunities for people. I mean, there's lots of research projects going on. We're setting up a network for therapists who are interested in helping people integrate psychedelic experiences, so rather than giving them psychedelics and sitting with them, they just because that's a bit of a no-no technically, but you know, they could just help people who've had experiences who want to just kind of work through that and make sense of it.
So that's a really key thing, I think, the integration piece of all this work, because I mean, you can just go and you see people just go from experience to experience purely for experience sake, which is fine. But then, you know, if you can pull these things together and understand, like, right, what's going on, like, where's the benefits to me, and how is this kind of, how does this fit into the picture of my life and what I'm doing, and that kind of stuff, like, integration is essential. And I think it's often missing in a lot of personal exploration. I think that's an amazing idea, and really needs to be pushed. And I wonder, like, how, have you developed any kind of methods of integration in your own kind of life?
Well, I'm not a therapist, but I mean, I think it's useful to have some framework, yeah, to put it in. I mean, I think kind of there are some within kind of conventional psychology. I mean, a lot of conventional psychology is quite useful, but a lot of it falls down at the psychedelic experience and the kind of, you know, the mystical experience or the exceptional experiences. You know, you can look to kind of Jung, maybe kind of help with those kind of things. It's also useful to kind of maybe look to people who have been using these things for a very long time, like indigenous groups around the world, in the Americas particularly. I've been working with a Waradica and a tribe in Mexico, and they've been using peyote cactus for probably, I don't know, archaeological evidence suggests at least 5,500 years, you know. So you can look to them and see these are a completely psychedelic culture, and so they have a very different way of navigating and interacting with these substances and integrating their experiences. Obviously their cosmology is way beyond our kind of ken in a way, it's but there's certain ways in which they interact with these things and deal with them that we can learn from that. I think, you know, we can look to both, kind of knowledge traditions of the so-called West and more kind of wisdom traditions of your other indigenous cultures.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about things like ritual and ceremonial approaches to these things. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that they have a kind of set and setting, you know. I mean, the thing with the psychedelic experience, as with all altered states really, is set and setting. You know, this three substance is kind of like plays a somewhat trivial role compared to set and setting, you know. And your set is the psychological framework, I'm going into the experience, and the setting is where you do it and what circumstances, and like ceremonial ritual structure has a lot to offer in that regard, you know. So that in itself is useful. It doesn't necessarily always help you with the integration, but the experience itself, it can very much guide the experience. But there's still work needs to be done afterwards, you know.
Yeah. In my personal experience, it's been very much the case that the ceremonial side of it is paramount to the positive outcome of the whole thing. And there's been, you know, the times where either I was a bit of a naive idiot and didn't do any of that, or didn't have an intention, and there's been some pretty difficult times to go through in those things. This one I remember was shortly after I got back from South America, and I'd just had a couple of quite eye-opening experiences with ayahuasca and out there, and I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I can just cook this up myself, easy. I'm gonna try and, you know, experiment myself, and, you know, see how this goes. And I bought all the herbs online, and I read them. Had a friend out there who ran a centre, and he sent me a recipe, and he was like, you know, that's how you learn, you know, through personal experimentation. I was like, okay, all right, give it a go. And I did this for every couple of weeks. I'd cook up a brew, and I'd kind of do it with, you know, with love and blowing tobacco and doing the stuff that I'd seen and heard out there. And but the one time that I did it and just drank it without any real sense of what I was doing, why I was doing it, with no kind of preparation of the space. That was the time where this crazy time where it felt like something entered my being, this kind of black spirit-like thing, and it's like myself was pushed to one side and Jody wasn't really there anymore, and there's this thing just like in me looking out of my eyes going, oh, this is interesting, now I'm in your body. And this went on for hours, you know, and it freaked me the fuck out. And I know you've written about spirit possession and that kind of stuff, and I was wondering what's your kind of view on where is it on the kind of the spirit side of things, like, are these things, is this something that was generated in my mind, you know, was there really a spirit? It's so hard to kind of quantify what was going on. I mean, for me, it very much felt real, that something external to me, I felt it come into me, into my being, as it were. But then you could easily say, oh, well, that was just, you know, an aspect of your darkness, of your psychological stuff that just was opened up by the chemicals. You know, where do you come down on all that, having gone through your own experiences with this stuff?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, I don't think science helps us particularly very much here. I mean, the kind of the standard scientific pattern would be, well, you know, there's no such thing as spirits. It's just coming from your own psychology. And it's very hard to kind of prove or disprove that, right? So despite some admirable attempts, so we don't really know is the answer, I would say.
In your research on spirit possession, though, how did you find the cultures that you were looking at?
I've been kind of traveling, engaging with various cultures who take part in spirit possession, transmediumship, and also psychedelic shamanism and stuff. I mean, we can't really say much about the existence or not of spirits, particularly from a scientific perspective, or not. You know, we don't really know. So it's kind of useful to kind of keep an open mind, I think,
and
whatever works best for you in interpreting that experience. I mean, that kind of leaves you out in the cold a bit in terms of an explanation. But in my research on spirit possession and psychedelics, I didn't even bother trying to engage with the question of the reality of it or not.
Right.
I just looked at the kind of when and how these experiences occur, you know, and the cultural.
I mean, it's almost
aspects.
Kind of, it's almost the power of belief is almost more important than whether something's true or not.
Sure.
So, you know, if you, whatever you believe to be true, it's kind of true for you, really.
Definitely. And it's good to, I think it's why it's good to be agnostic, you know, because, you know, if you can get, you know, convictions make convicts, you know, your beliefs are prisons. You could get caught in this idea that you had some kind of spirit possession and that could really haunt you, you know, or you could just say it was, you know, your inner psychology and that might be kind of preventing you from having a more spiritually fulfilling life, you know. So I think we just try and be agnostic. I try and be agnostic.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there was this organization called the Spirit Relief Foundation. It was started out with a psychiatrist, and he was essentially doing kind of like exorcisms on the NHS.
until
on
the NHS?
For a few years. His colleagues didn't really mind. It was the psychiatric nurses that got upset. But he was using a technique, and other people have been using it since, and it's kind of like a mild hypnotic technique with a gestalt. You know, you would say, can you feel some kind of being around you or there? And you would just invite in whatever presence you felt and engage them in a kind of dialogue. And so the important thing is, he says, we're not really saying whether these are spirits or not. Certainly this is what Andrew Powell was saying, but it's whatever helps the patient. If it really helps them to kind of view it as they're engaging with the spirit of their aborted fetus or whatever, you know, and they think they're having a real interaction, then that's fine. Or they could just feel like it's just a psychological encounter.
Sure.
But whatever works for you, really.
I mean, that's the kind of the stuff, the criticism that gets levelled at shamanic work a lot is like, well, you know, it's not real. You're just kind of talking about all these animal spirits and blah, blah, blah. But it's kind of like, well, there's an energy attached to these things, and what you're doing is like working with the how this feels and how it makes you feel. And if you call in the spirit of a wolf and it makes you feel really strong and powerful, then brilliant. You know, that's how can you disavow that, really?
Absolutely.
And say that it's irrelevant. So, yeah, I think... I don't know where I was going with that.
You were going somewhere, though. Got into, good.
Yeah,
no, I
the shamanic
totally
aspect of things, and the kind of the this idea that there's a spirit world full of beings and you know and energies that are open to working with us, that kind of helps people to ground a lot of this stuff, which is so far out from their normal sphere of reference. That, like you say, it's the indigenous cultural perspectives.
There's also a difficulty in that there's a cultural gulf, you know. It's like it's part of their culture, and they often have like very complex cosmologies go along with it. And it's in a sense no different from us in the West. We have a kind of broader cultural cosmology, and you know, in the kind of secular world, that's, you know, science and the academy and all the rest of it, and modern Western medicine. But that also falls down at certain points. But it also has its own kind of completeness, if you like. It's complete. It has holes, but it's a kind of working model of reality, which is imbibed with a sense of truth by people who live within it. So much so that you can't see outside of it, you know. But that's our cultural bubble. So when we go to another culture in Peru or whatever and drink ayahuasca, and they talk with kind of, you know, singing your kind of your symmetry straight and communicating with spirits of nature, that's a whole other world and reality, but that works for them, you know. And so whatever, I mean, the limits of our reality are our beliefs, you know. But it becomes quite difficult to work outside of the world of your kind of belief system.
Sure, the framework of the way that you've been brought up and the way that things are true and what is true and isn't true. And,
yeah.
So when you go to a culture where magic is real, or magical things are just part of the way society functions, you can't help but your perception shifts.
Absolutely.
You know, when you're in those places, because the general perception people in that place is that this is how things are. So you kind of, you know, it becomes more real, and you hear stories of people, like, forget where it was, it might have been in one of Oliver Sacks' books, but there's a guy talking about I think he was an anthropologist, and he's in Mexico, and he goes to see like a psychic surgeon. And he's, you know, he's coming from the Western viewpoint of this is bullshit, but I'm going to go and objectively try and objectively look at it. And he sees this woman's hand going inside the body, and she pulls out all this stuff, and he sees it, and he's freaking out because it's so far out of his comfort zone of what's real. But he sees it, and his eyes are like, I'm seeing this. This is happening. You know, no one's going to believe that. But there's so much outside the realm of what we think we know. You know, no one really knows if that's possible or not. But he was in the situation where he saw this stuff going on with his own eyes, and becomes kind of real for you.
I mean, in the West, we have a prejudice. We have a kind of certainty in our belief, you know, in a general sense that these things aren't real and can't be possible. Well, certainly for people within, you know, mainstream science in the academy. I think you ask the general public, they're not so arrogant and remain a bit more open to it. But he did better than I did, because I went to see a psychic surgeon in Brazil thinking the same, that it was all bullshit. But because I'd read a lot about these Filipino psychic surgeons who use sleight of hand, and they'll pull out,
yeah,
you know, chicken giblets. They do a
the
good kind of
theatre side of that,
yeah,
work is definitely a thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I thought the same thing was going to happen with this Brazilian psychic surgeon until he pulled out a scalpel and started cutting people open. Cutting people open. I was like, oh shit. And I was in the queue to have a treatment, and I was like, I suddenly like had this terrible, terrible fear, you know, just cold sweats, shakings, like, oh shit, it's going to pull the scalpel on me. And I didn't sign up for this.
But did he, you know, was he able to then seal up the body? Or
no, he just left them with a kind of gaping wound, and then led them off, somebody lead them off, and the next one would
someone
come along.
Crossed out the word psychic on the board.
Wow, well, it was fascinating what he was doing. I mean, essentially, it's like a whatever paranormal aspects that there may or may not be to it, and I didn't really see any. It's a massive placebo, and in many ways, that's no different from a lot of Western medicine either, you know. Particularly when you're talking about psychiatric treatments, like the effectiveness of kind of antidepressants and whatnot are barely better than placebo. And the placebo is the majority of the effect.
And that's where we go back to, like, the power of belief in these things work. This is going to cure me, or this is going to help me, or, you know.
Yeah.
And then it does. Because the mind-body connection is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
And that we really don't understand, you know. Am I right that you did your PhD, your original PhD was in the psychology of luck?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, that's such a fascinating subject. How did you go down that road? Because that's kind of like slightly off down a different path than the altered states kind of thing.
Yeah, well, there wasn't anybody you could get a PhD in psychology to supervise on psychedelics at the time. And also, I didn't think I was going to do a PhD anyway. I did my degree. I'd been asked to lecture after my degree, and I did that for a while. But I went away travelling, and I didn't really want to go back to psychology because I thought it was so blinkered. But then my granddad rang me up one day after I finished my degree, shortly after, and he was like, oh, I've got an idea for a PhD for you on luck, fate and the spiritual experience. I was like, but I was in the middle of something. He was like, oh, yeah,
thanks,
that sounds
granddad.
Great. Yeah, I'm not going to do a PhD, though. He's like, no, this is what you're going to do. And I was like, I'll tell you what, I'll come and see you in a couple of weeks and you can tell me about it. And sure enough, he died a week later. And I was like, you bastard.
Wow.
So, but I didn't plan on doing it. But then actually, I think I was in Mexico and it was on a peyote vision. I realised I had to go back and do this PhD.
As a kind of honouring of your granddad's idea?
I realised if I was going to go, I needed to kind of carry on lecturing and researching, and that seemed like just as good an idea as any, really. And I thought parapsychology, which is kind of the field I did it in, was kind of the closest, it was at least open to altered states out of any kind of branch of psychology.
Sure.
I didn't really know about transpersonal psychology at the time, so I figured, well, I'll do it on a more mainstream kind of subject, but in a field which is open to altered states, you know.
So how did that, you know, what were your findings out of that? How did the experiments work?
Yeah, I mean, so I did a kind of lots of different, I did some interviews with people and I developed some kind of measures and I did some experiments. The experiments were good fun. So it was a precognition experiment again, but I was looking to see if people who self-identified with being lucky and had a particular belief about what luck is, because some people say, oh, I'm lucky, but people mean different things when they talk about luck, right? So some people just use it as a means of kind of expressing gratitude for not living in a shithole or whatever, you know, and other people think it's something random and inert, you know, like just pure coincidence. And other people think it's something, you know, some kind of magical force in nature. Other people think it's kind of guided by God or... So there's different viewpoints. So if people think it's something that isn't just inert or something they're just grateful for, then, and they think they're lucky, then the idea being that they might be better, more psychically adroit, you know, psychically capable, in that, you know, there's a million and one things happen throughout our lifetime where we have such scrapes with death or accidents, and, you know, it's a miracle we get through life, really, personally.
Yeah.
And it could be, well, you know, if we had some kind of subtle unconscious psychic processes at work, which would kind of unconsciously guide us to certain actions, which is one of the theories in parapsychology, then, you know, it would look like you were lucky. You know,
so is it, are you talking about synchronicity, Jung's synchronicity there?
Yeah, so synchronicities or maybe just unconscious precognition about things that are going to happen. So I did a kind of an unconscious precognition experiment. And basically the task was, you know, you just look at some images, random fractal images, and you'd pick which one you like the most very quickly. Just so people aren't even thinking, they don't know it's a psychic test, they're just asked to pick which picture they resonate with the most, you know. However, then the computer picks one at random, like unknown to them,
right,
after they've picked theirs. So it's precognition, and if you pick the same one as the computer, you score a point, kind of thing.
Okay.
And if so, then the after a few trials, they get a score, you know, and they should get 25% by chance. But if they do better than chance, they get an unconscious reward. They'd get rewarded. And I needed to find something that was kind of a reward, which is kind of common to everybody. You could give them chocolate, maybe. Yeah. But so something kind of primal. So I showed them erotic images, basically. And the better they did on the task, the more erotic the images got. So it's like, you know, there was a real kind of sense in which they don't even know it, but if they do well, they're going to see a bit of porn.
It's funny how that and that kind of phrase, you know, getting lucky.
Exactly.
Well, you got lucky, or I'm getting lucky tonight.
And as a counterpoint, if they did badly, I gave them one of these cognitive psychology tasks to do, which are really boring, because cognitive psychology is pretty boring and arduous. You know, these kind of vigilance tasks where they have to kind of just kind of guess sequences of numbers, you know, observation tasks. And guess what? It worked really well, you know. So, like, people would be unconsciously precognitive beyond chance expectation in exchange for a pornographic reward.
Yeah.
That was basically my PhD thesis.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And also, you know, producing quite meaningful conclusions. So that then went on to inspire further work in those, with the precog stuff.
And yeah, most of my experimental work's been with precognition.
Right, okay.
I knew you were going to say that.
Now I'm like, ooh, it's reading my mind. So you seem like a very busy guy. You've got the book writing, the conventions, the lecturing, the teaching, not to mention probably about 50 things I haven't said. How do you find, like, what does your day look like? How do you juggle these things? How do you find the kind of discipline to jump between these things? Does it come naturally?
Yeah, just get on and do it, really.
Yeah.
Synchronicity helps.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really kind of believe in synchronicity anymore. I kind of rely on it, you know. It's like, it can really help, you know. I think if you're in like a flow and you've got a lot of balls up in the air and you don't live a particularly, you're not too rigid about things, you know, you think of something, you go, oh, yeah. And
so then, you're able to kind of just feel the nudges in one direction or the other.
Well, no, you just go with what works. And if suddenly somebody's asking you a particular question about something and then that afternoon somebody else pops up and goes, oh, I'm an expert in this, and you just put them two together. And
okay,
you know, that seems to kind of be that helps.
Yeah. But you must have like an underlying pretty strong work ethic to
I work too much, probably. That's my wife.
So have you developed any kind of personal practices to help you sort of over the years stay grounded with all this stuff and stay, you know?
Well, I mean, I spend more time kind of talking and researching altered states than I do getting into them these days. I mean, I don't even remember my dreams much these days and that's a freebie, you know, you get those every night because I, you know, just get up too abruptly and get on with my work. So
yeah.
No difficulty grounding. Probably difficulty just ungrounding. These days, yeah.
Switching it off.
Well, there's a danger in not practicing what you preach. I mean, I'm in danger of becoming out of touch with my research subject, I think.
Sure, right. You know, so do you set
somebody
time?
Get me high? No, I didn't say that.
I mean, it almost sounds like you need to set some time aside for your own little, your own experiences again.
Yeah, to be honest, I've done a lot of experiential work in my time, and I'm still processing a lot of that, and I'm writing about it and drawing upon it. But it's, yeah, of course, it's useful, and I will take time out now and then to do some field research, which is important, and it can really help inform your work and inspire you, and you know, of course.
So, how have you managed juggling all the things that you do with being a new dad, which you are?
Yeah, that's kind of great.
I imagine that's like a big game changer.
Ah, it's brilliant. Yeah, no, it's really amazing. I was lucky enough to get 9 months paid leave from work last year under a scheme called shared parental leave, which was amazing. So I just went off to the mountains.
That sounds progressive.
Shared parental leave. I mean, it came in with the Tories. There must have been an accident or an overhang from like, from Labour or something.
It sounds very Scandinavian.
Doesn't it just? Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. And it's to encourage you know, women to kind of stay in the workplace and not lag behind on their careers. It hasn't really been taken up very much. I think I was the first person in my whole faculty who'd first man, obviously, to taken it up last year. But it's only been around for a couple of years now. But it was great. And I was able to spend 9 months looking after the baby while my wife wrote her novels.
Wow.
Partly, we kind of shared a lot of the workload as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Just lived up in the mountains in Wales. And
oh yeah, whereabouts?
In Snowdonia. Opposite Snowdon, in fact. In an eco-retreat centre.
Beautiful part of the world, North Wales.
Yeah.
Yeah, I lived up there for a small period of time a few years ago in the Tanat Valley. Mm. I don't know if you know that. It's where they've got the tallest waterfall in England and Wales.
Amazing.
Llan Rhyadr, that's the town where they've got that, and the Berwyn Mountains are just background. It's kind of just southwest of just outside the border of Snowdonia. You go up on the top of the Berwyns and you can see straight to Snowdon.
Okay, great.
On a clear day, you know, and it's a wonderful place. It's just so wild.
Is it Bala? Is there a lake there?
It's on the way to Bala.
I've been driven through there the once, but yeah, that's so. This is like further up in the north, kind of. The kind of peak of the Snowdonia, yeah.
Wow.
But beautiful. I love the mountains.
Yeah.
It's kind of my spiritual home, I
think.
Yeah,
there's something really magical about mountains, eh?
Mm.
So were you sad to leave?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm happy wherever I'm. I like Forest Row, it's good. But the mountains are great, and I get to go back there, and I'm running a retreat there in a couple of weeks, actually, so that should be fun.
Oh, is this the Neuro Magica
thing? Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how that came about? Because it's like as if you hadn't got enough on your plate, right? I think I'm just going to, you know, run some retreats as well.
Well, it's, you know, for shits and giggles,
yeah.
You know.
But it sounds amazing, and it's kind of collaborative, right?
Yeah. So I mean, I just put it out there, and I had a really good response. It sold out in like a week, the first one, and some people offered to kind of help, and so I said, sure, join in, and so I had some help from Nikki Weird, who also works with us on Breaking Convention, and now Julian Vane as well, her partner, is also joining me, and so it's kind of like an experiential exploration of my kind of oeuvre, if you like. So
yeah.
The intersection between science and magic, and so kind of grounded in kind of Western science and psychology, but exploring kind of other approaches as well, you know, kind of indigenous approaches and non-academic approaches to altered states and magic, basically.
Mm.
So just exploring that, really, in a beautiful set in deep nature, you know, because I think nature's kind of really important in all of this, really.
Yeah, definitely.
That's where the magic happens.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's another thing that I think's that psychedelics and entheogens, whatever you want to call them, can really do is help us heal that divide, you know, between the natural world, or remember that we are part of, there is no divide, really.
Absolutely.
You know, because it is all just the same thing when you, especially when you have some of these experiences and they break down those perceptions of separateness from the natural world especially. But
yeah, we're kind of part of nature, not apart from nature. And that's, you know, one thing the psychedelics and other alt states or just being in nature shows you, you know.
Mm.
I actually did a survey last year, the year before, 2 years ago. I haven't published it yet. I haven't got time. But we looked at how psychedelic experiences change eco-consciousness, basically.
Huh.
And, you know, the vast majority of people in our survey said it made them more ecologically aware, more connected with nature, in most cases more concerned for nature, in a few cases less concerned for nature.
Is this following an experience in nature-based scenarios?
No, just having just psychedelic experiences in general. Presumably, those are kind of amplified.
Walking around the centre of London, and well, you never know.
No, you
never
could be. You know, it's like hugging the trees and the street. But I mean, it's just like across all people's experiences, so their lifetime of psychedelic experiences, whether it increased their connections with nature, and you know, even to the point where people, the majority of people, had increased their kind of ecological behaviours as well, so not just their attitudes. So people doing more gardening, changing their diet, maybe becoming vegetarian, vegan, organic, whatever, taking part in ecological activism, and even people changing their careers. Like 16% changed their careers, in fact, to more ecological oriented.
Yeah, this is a really big thing, I think, and yeah, you should definitely get that out there.
Well, it's not going to change anyone's mind who hasn't already changed their mind.
No, but
it's important data, I think.
Yeah, the more of this stuff that's kind of available to people who are maybe on the fringes and just interested in, oh, somebody did a study in this, darling. Did you know?
I mean, they could help us save the planet. I mean, who knows?
You know, it might change somebody's mind, and if it does, that's a great thing.
Yeah.
Especially in the kind of crazy place we find ourselves these days, you know, with so much crime against the natural world going on.
Eco-side,
yeah. Yeah. Billy Higgins doing lots of work.
Amazing work, yeah, brilliant.
Mm.
And also it's kind of two-way street, isn't it? Because once you kind of start engaging with nature itself does the healing, right? You know, eco-psychology is essentially that. It's like the very act of immersing yourself in nature has a healing potential because of, you know, urbanization causes alienation. You know, most psychological diseases are more prevalent in urban settings. You know, something like 30% of the workforce in London are depressed.
Yeah.
Clinically depressed. And schizophrenia is higher in urban environments. So it's urbanisation.
It's symptomatic of the 21st century lifestyle.
Absolutely, yeah, massively. Yeah. And we're losing our connection with nature, you know. Kids, perfect timing. Is a helicopter going overhead. Further off! We're in nature!
Yeah. How dare you?
Right, thank you. Yeah. I'll put the remote control down now. The sound effects pedal.
Yeah, put the drone photo camera down. Yeah. I can't remember. What were we talking about then? Yeah, disconnection.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? I mean, we've crossed the tipping point a few years ago whereby there's more people living in urban conurbations than rurally. And you got, you know, the rise of kind of mega cities like Sao Paulo and Beijing, you know, 30
Mexico
million
City.
Plus people.
Yeah.
And so people are growing up without any connection to nature whatsoever. You know, children are growing up, they don't even know what animal their meat comes from or what it looks like. You know, they just get this kind of plastic packeted kind of chunk of meat on their table. And it's really important to have any kind of ecological awareness or consciousness. You need to have some connection to nature, right, first of all. And I think psychedelics and eco-psychology and rewilding is really important in that, I think, in helping guide us in that direction.
Sure. Have you got any kind of a philosophy on where this stuff is going and where everything's building to, if we're, you know, is it just a kind of unfolding? Let's just see.
Yeah, it's going to get weirder, I'll tell you that much for sure. I mean, the future's kind of reversing as in high speed. And we've all got to hang on for the ride, really.
Did you see that thing the other day? Sorry to interrupt you there. Just were you talking about the kind of the reverse Big Bang effect there? The future's reversing as at high speed.
Yeah, in a way.
There was a model I saw the other day where they were saying that there was no beginning and end, perhaps, you know. And there's like a cylindrical thing with just... it just was existence. There was no beginning, which is, I don't know if that's how much study they've done with that model, but I mean that's quite an interesting one when you think about how much we've based on the Big Bang thing as the way things are, and I think it'd be really fascinating to get some stuff that was going on in the world that just flipped everything that we knew about the way things are and the origins of life itself. You know, it's going to take something, I think, quite big for people, especially people who are so entrenched in their way of life that, you know, why should they change? Why should they care more about nature? And, you know, because it's quite individualistic.
Certainly.
A lot of the way people live at the moment.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, particularly in our Western culture, you know, capitalist engine and individualism and all the rest of it. I mean, the whole Big Bang thing is a conundrum, isn't it? I mean, it's a really handy convenience of modern scientific thinking that, because you can't seem to stretch any further back than that, you know, it fits our models of, well, we
there
have
must
these...
must be a start and a finish.
well, these models, and these laws, and this is how it happened because the universe has expanded. It started off as this kind of contracted little ball, and as Terence McKenna said, though, you know, give me one free miracle, and I'll kind of provide you. I'll explain all your other miracles, basically. And the free miracle was the Big Bang, basically. You know, right, that everything started at this one time point. You know, all the laws of physics and nature just kind of intact, and all the matter and energy of the universe contained in this one tiny little pinhead. Really? I mean, come on. I mean, what happened before that? Yeah, it's quite convenient, you know. It's just kind of just to the limits of our kind of imagination, really. But for sure, that's not the whole picture. Mm. Or the idea then that, you know, we live in this kind of Newtonian, billiard ball, mechanistic universe where everything since the Big Bang is kind of predetermined from that one massive expansion. And we live in a kind of predetermined world. That's also quite ridiculous in many respects. And then also you talked about, you know, the idea of the origins of life itself. Well, you know, biology hasn't even really defined what life is, or medicine or anything. It's the old acronym MERING, you know, movement, excretion, respiration, blah, blah, blah. But what life, you know, nothing, we've not yet managed to make life from no life. I've done some interesting experiments now where they've created hybrid kind of organisms with kind of spliced in DNA, but that's not the same. And they said the headlines were, you know, scientists create life in the lab, but they haven't created life. They used an already living organism. And so a part of you and a part of me and part of everything that's alive, it has been alive for billions of years, because that your cells in your body came from other living cells, you know, which, so that there's a part of you who's never died from billions of years. We don't really understand what that is. Is there some kind of life force? What is necessary for life to exist? Is it actually possible to just put the requisite chemicals in a petri dish
and grow a being?
And would it be alive? Maybe. I don't think so. It's never been done. Mm. And the scientists will say, well, you know, we've pretty much worked out that life was formed in the deep oceans under lots of pressure, but we haven't recreated it. It's a bit of an assumption, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot of anomalous, you know, things that crop up throughout history that question our story of how things have gone. You know, you
Absolutely.
Look at Graham Hancock's work and people like that doing research into pre-existing civilizations and, you know, the... I can't remember, is it the Ica in Peru, the people with the long skulls that they found that seem quite a mystery. There's the maps that pre-exist. There's a lot of, you know, really interesting anomalies that seem to suggest that all is not quite as we think it is.
No, for sure. I mean, our current picture of the universe it's got a lot of big holes in it, you know, and it's interesting, though, but, you know, we live in an age of promissory science where it's like we don't have all the answers yet, but, I mean, our current models are essentially of the universe are all right, and we just got to fill in a few gaps. But it's like, okay, so we haven't yet fully explained how the brain produces consciousness, but give us a few years, we'll do it. We haven't yet worked out how genes code for all of our human kind of physiology and psychology, etc. But give us a few years and we will do, you know.
It's
just around the corner. We'll just ignore all these anomalies in the meantime. But the anomalies are growing, and the explanations from mainstream science getting further and further away as things become more and more complex. I think.
I mean, there's a lot of people these days talking about the rise of technology as a kind of super being that might somehow influence human evolution, especially with things like VR, which is kind of a big thing at the moment, and people people having altered states experiences through virtual reality, you know, looking down and there's no feet and arms and you're in this space which isn't real, but it feels quite real. I mean, it's in its beginnings, but there's a lot of people getting very excited about the potential for what these kind of things will do for the human perception, the human mind. So I was wondering, you know, are there any future areas that you're looking to, that you're going to look into that you haven't yet? You know, things like, I don't know, things like, have you done anything with sensory deprivation and darkness and that kind of stuff? Or even down this technological road of VR? And I mean, there is even a whole Reddit, I think, subreddit about people using psychedelics in VR. Mm-hmm. And having these kind of like lucid dream experiences.
Yeah, the possibilities are endless. Like I say, it's going to get weirder. I mean, the VR thing is deeply fascinating. I mean, yeah, you can induce kind of out-of-body experiences or something akin to out-of-body experiences, maybe not the same as the spontaneous ones, with VR. And a lot of people are getting into looking into the overlap between psychedelics and VR. Hopefully, the breaking this year, we're going to be exploring that cyberdelics, you know. It's a bit of a thing among a lot of your VR people, kind of also resisting the big companies as well, just like, right. And looking at it, you know, in a kind of more egalitarian kind of grassroots way, and treating them like a psychedelic experience. So it's like, hey, I've just knocked together this kind of program, put on the headset, immerse yourself in my 5-minute Timothy Leary VR trip, you know. And in the same way in which people at a party would say, hey, look, I've got some really nice Afghani black, or have a smoke on this, and somebody drops you a pill or whatever. Not the kind of parties I go to, I hasten to add. And so they're treating these kind of VR experiences as like psychedelic experiences, and people are creating their own. It's like, hey, look what I knocked up, you know.
Yeah, that's the fascinating thing, where it becomes in the user's hands, you know, how can I design this? I can design the parameters of, well, the parameters of the program, and then you go into it and have your experience. But there's an element of you being the human being the designer, or allowing the technology to kind of assist in that process, which I think is really fascinating. The technology's just crept into everything nowadays, you know. I can't see a future really, unless something catastrophic happens to force us away from it. It seems like there's going to be a merging of technology and the human side of things.
Well, we've always had technology, you know, kind of part of the thing that defines us as humans, even fires a technology, but it's it's kind of built on limited material resources as well, so that, you know, that needs to be managed. I mean, coltan, etc. You know, so it's not a bottomless pit.
No,
but I think we'll always have technology, and it will evolve and so on and so forth. You know, a lot of the people in AI and VR are kind of asking these kind of existential questions now, you know, this transhumanism movement and Elon Musk and his whole kind of Gnostic, are we living in a kind of matrix world? It kind of begs the question, if we can make VR simulations that are indistinguishable from your normal everyday experience, then maybe are we already living in a simulation? This is Nick Bostrom, Oxford academic, kind of came with this simulation hypothesis, and it's like, I'll be already living in the matrix, right? And therefore there must be some higher order programmers, like entities or something. One of the things we're looking at, we're doing this series of symposia on DMT entities, and one of the questions we want to ask is, well, you know, how does that tie in with this whole simulation hypothesis? Which is an old idea, you know. The Gnostics basically said that we're living in this kind of material world delusion, and these higher order entities, archons, who are kind of running running the matrix, basically.
And when were they kind of talking about this kind of stuff? Is this pre-Christian Gnostics?
No, Gnostics are kind of Christian, so kind of sometime, I don't know, I kind of know the exact century, but post, but it's kind of just 1 AD kind of thing, and
long enough ago
2017.
long enough ago that it was quite radical, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, well, it's probably not. Well, it probably wasn't even a new idea then.
But
it's kind of been dressed up again now in this kind of AI VR kind of model. Mm-hmm. But it kind of begs a lot of questions. I mean, the whole... I went to the launch. My friend Carl Smith, who's speaking at my salon next month, he's just been given the Britain's first hollow portal to play with.
Hollow portal?
Hollow portal is where it's like a blue screen. You know, you can video somebody in a blue screen, mm-hmm. right? But this is like an array of 16 high-definition cameras in a kind of 360 all around blue screen.
Wow.
And so you've filmed people from all these different angles in high definition video, and then you can projection map, but you can project them into someone's field of view wearing VR goggles, or even better, HoloLenses, which a HoloLens is like a set of glasses.
Yeah.
But they've got little projector screens inside them, just above your eyes.
Yeah.
And they also respond to kind of motion and all the rest of it. And so you can insert elements from computer graphics, but not only that, now with a
kind of like Google Glass, but the next level.
Exactly, a HoloLens. But then you can insert things from the Holo portal, so you can have people like living, working, alive people in your field of view in the room. You know, when you turn your head, I mean, I went and had a look, and you know, turned your head, and there's a ballerina just kind of poised in space in the room. Like, you can see all these other people in the room, there's a ballerina just frozen there, and you're able to reach out and click on them with your fingers, and they start dancing pirouettes. You know, that's now a reality. So I asked the question, so do we have like a Turing test for this, like, you know, where the hollow, what are they calling it, like a mixed reality, I think they call
augmented.
It. Well, augmented is slightly different because that's using kind of computer graphics. This is using kind of veridical video graphic, right? So they're calling it mixed reality. And how can we work out the point of where that becomes indistinguishable from, like with the Turing test, you know, where AI becomes indistinguishable from a person?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I came up with the Deturing test, which is on Datura, which is one of those psychedelics which gives you true hallucinations, you know. So we'll be sitting here, and suddenly a werewolf will come and sit next to me, and I'll start chatting to them.
Yeah.
But everything else seems completely normal. And even then, you don't question the werewolf because you've lost your sense of kind of rationality, and the werewolf disappears. That's Datura, you know. You don't get that on most psychedelics.
No.
So you could have like some kind of test where people are on Datura and wearing the mixed reality gear, and if they can't tell the difference, then, you know, there you go. You've got a seamless kind of reality augmentation.
Well, that sounds like the future of your research, right?
Yeah, it's probably completely unethical, but, you know, as a thought experiment.
Find yourself having a cigarette even though you've given up.
Well, that was my kind of acid test in my own lucid dreams. Like, you know, I'd given up smoking for 3 months, and then I found myself having a cigarette. I was like, why on earth am I smoking? I can't believe I've tried so hard to give up. Why am I smoking? And I tried to work my way back as to how I'd started having a cigarette, and it occurred to me, do you know, I must be dreaming. And then I just went for a little fly, you know. I was like, this is lucid dream. And so just kind of retro explaining what I just said whilst the recorder was off, you know, you could apply the same thing to the Turing test. You know, I think AI will develop it in such a way that, or VR as well, sorry, VR, that you can tap all the various senses. At the minute, it's just kind of auditory, visual, and kind of kinesthetic, you know, in terms of your motion. But, you know, in time, you'll tap your olfactory senses as well, maybe. Taste would be quite difficult.
Yeah.
But also, you know, pressure, touch. But there'll always be some telltale sign, like in a lucid dream. Uh-huh. But you'll have to reality test to find out whether you're in a VR simulation or not. Because in a dream, you don't really... You could work out your dreaming. You can ask those kind of questions, like, why am I having a cigarette? And yet we don't. You have to train yourself to reality test when you're awake and when you're in a dream. So,
sure.
And I think the same thing's going to come in with kind of VR as it kind of extends and becomes harder and harder to distinguish from the dream from the waking life.
It's all a dream.
It's all a dream. Dreams within dreams.
That's what I was going to say.
That's all that precognition research, you see. I knew you were going to say
Tuning in. Dave, thanks so much for your time today.
It's been brilliant.
Really, really great. Thank you for making time out of your what sounds like pretty busy schedule.
Oh, it's all good fun. And, well, thanks and good luck with the podcast. It sounds great.
Thank you. If people want to find out more about Breaking Convention, that is breakingconvention.co.uk.
It is breakingconvention.co.uk. Breaking with a G. There's also another event which runs annually called Break In Convention without a G.
Which I found out the other day when I was Googling it, and it's a hip-hop breakdancing thing.
Yeah, we often get a few applications of people like kind of submitting dance. They're like, hey, we want to come to a breaking convention. We're a hip-hop outfit. We're like, yeah, sure, come. I don't think it's what you think it is.
Well, there might be some crossover somewhere.
Yeah. We'll have to
pretty nice to get the psychedelic breakdance crews out.
Yeah. Maybe this year it could happen.
So that's Breaking Convention. What about all the other stuff? If people are interested in finding out about the salons and the Neuromagica retreats.
Other events and stuff I do. I have a Facebook group called Ecology, Cosmos and Consciousness, which is the same name of my salon, which is every month, usually last Tuesday of the month in the October Gallery in Bloomsbury in central London. There's a salon. We invite a speaker along and hang out and drink wine and shoot the shit. But there's also kind of retreats and other events and stuff.
And most things will come through that. That's a Facebook group.
Yeah. And then I've got all of my academic stuff. There's a whole list of my papers and talks and stuff
online.
Are they
published online?
Most of them, yeah, apart from a few which are in books and stuff which I haven't put on there. And that's on academia.edu, which is a kind of a place for academics to put their papers, and just look up David Luke on there.
Fantastic. Well,
thanks so much, Jody.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your time, man.
No worries, I really enjoyed it. Cheers.
Oh, wasn't that great? Bit of psychedelic, precognitive entheogenic goodness. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. David Luke. We had a great time recording it, and thanks again to Dave for making time for me. All that remains to be said is, if you want to find out more about the music that I play at the start and the end of this show, that is Light of the Light by Ben Chasney, aka Six Organs of Admittance, go to www.sixorgans.com. And his record label, Drag City, you can find them at www.dragcity.com. If you want to find out more about Breaking Convention, the fourth international conference on psychedelics, which is happening this year at Greenwich University, do visit www.breakingconvention.co.uk, and I'll see you there.